Hello and welcome to this episode of the Restless Entertainment Questions and Answers Edition. I'm Marina Hyde.
And I'm Richard Osman. Hello, Marina.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm so well. I'm ready to answer.
Ready? Of course you are.
Yeah.
Of course you are.
Are you ready to question?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah, I'm ready to question. She's like, oh, go on.
No, I would like you to question me.
Okay, I have a question. Well, John Andrews wants to question you.
Question your worst.
Yeah. John says, what is the benefit of politicians going on shows like Have I Got News For You, where they're often the butt of all the jokes, like Louise Haig? Are they requested or do they request to be on the show?
Well, they are asked. If you look at the register of members' interest, they get paid. It's pretty standard to be. They tend not to host, with a couple of exceptions, which I'm sure we'll get to. But you get about £1,500 to £2,000. If you're for your appearance. I saw Louise Haig's one a few weeks ago. Yeah, that was a bit of a car crash. You don't have to say yes, of course. Mm. I have been asked many times to do the show, but have always said no. You get more for hosting, I should say. If you're the
you do,
yeah,
you get about a substantial multiple.
Yes. Are you hosting this week?
No,
are you on
God,
it?
No.
You're guesting.
I only ever hosted once, and because I couldn't read the autocue properly because of my nystagmus, people thought I was drunk. And so, and I'm much happier being a guest. I'm so much happier being a guest. Yeah, I was on it last week. Guesting is always much, much, much more fun than hosting. Hosting is really hard work, whereas guesting, you just get to say what you want.
Yes. And I suppose, so, they probably put in for everybody, and you could, or people who the people have actually heard of, you're not getting some obscure backbencher.
This week, interestingly, it's a very interesting week to ask this question, John Andrews, well done. Zach Polansky is on. And Zach Polansky, you know, the Greens are going up and up and up in the polls. A lot of people seem to be liking him. So for him, this will be out tomorrow if you listen to this on the Thursday, I think it might be a good thing.
But they will show the clip to anyone who hasn't seen the clip of Zach Polansky explaining that he can make a woman's breast larger via hypnosis in a previous life. They will show that clip again.
Yeah.
Now, what happened with Louise Haig, if people don't know this story, and obviously a lot more people know this story now she's been on Have I Got News than knew it before, is that she has a fraud conviction because she claimed to have had her company mobile phone, it was a BlackBerry, I think, stolen off her in a mugging. And in fact, she made a false claim of that, and she just wanted a better phone. She wanted an iPhone 5, I believe, at the time, which places that for you in the canon.
I think I think Zach Polansky could have made that happen with hypnotism.
Yes, he could have just got her a better phone.
You can upgrade your phone.
The answer is, there is one, obviously, we have seen a person who very successfully came to prominence, particularly via that programme, actually. Boris Johnson was asked that multiple times. Unfortunately, to make it work, obviously politicians, we live in an age of sort of anti-politics, and so the prize for all these people is to try and seem human.
Yeah.
And although our age of anti-politics seems to be only about politics, strangely, but anyway, so it's to try and seem human. Maybe Louise Haig's Spads thought, she'll seem human.
That's her special advisors.
That's it, yeah. But there's a reason that they thought that, and particularly must have thought now, is because she must be on some kind of, I keep seeing her on name linked with various kind of leadership manoeuvres within the Labour Party. They're less likely to go for her now after she's done that show. And I think, I mean, you know, never underestimate the ability of the Labour Party to do something absolutely nuts. But that this isn't going to happen. You have to be very, very good. And whether or not you like it, Boris Johnson was very, very good on this show. Mm. He had a unique persona. It was sort of uncategorizable. He had a very dangerous thing that where he was able to just laugh off these awful things, which she failed to do, Louise Haig, as an example. And obviously, whether or not you think it's right he was able to, it's a little bit like being a comedian on Traitors. You somehow can just sort of laugh and diffuse your way out of it. And it became a very valuable political tool.
We live in a sort of witocracy.
Yes.
Which is, if you can be funny and you want to rule the world, it's easier.
It's a real superpower to be able to do this, because it just manages to diffuse all sorts of difficult situations, to kind of divert away from things, and he was able to do that. And so I think people always just think, oh, if you're trying to expand your profile, that is a staging post. I would not go on it if I had a fraud conviction. I actually personally, Zach Polansky is just going to have to keep getting past the fact that he told people he could make their tits bigger by hypnosis. Yeah. He's just going to have to keep getting past that fact. But it will, more and more people will find out about it. People will just have to not mind about that, because he's doing very, very well.
Yes, I guess he thinks it. I mean, it's not something I was aware of, but
said he was sorry for it, and he keeps saying, like, I said I was sorry for it. It's like, yeah, I know, but you still did it, didn't you? Anyway.
You have to own it. It is still a very high profile show, Have I Got News For You. It still does very, very big numbers, you know, all these years later, you know, in an era where there are no more of those shows left, Have I Got News For You stands alone. It can be incredibly useful for you. You know, personal brand is everything these days in politics as much as anything else. So if you are Louise Hague, I guess you're thinking, what if it goes great? You know, if it goes badly, you know what?
What if they don't mention my fraud conviction?
Yeah, but even if
I'm just going to keep saying the word fraud conviction, because honestly, what were you thinking?
What if I get out in front of my fraud conviction? Yeah,
that's what they were thinking.
Because I've done a few.
What if I'm really witty and good and clever in a really kind of dark but brilliant way, like Boris Johnson? What if I'm like that? But you're not, are you?
The thing to spot, the thing you can see with a lot of politicians when they go on it, it's always my favourite thing, is the first round is always they show a little VT of something from the news that week. And they've seen it a million times before where it's like, you're going to be going, oh, there's Donald Trump. Oh, there's, you know, and leads on to a joke. So the politicians always go, oh, there he is, Donald Trump. Oh, he's in front of a plane. Oh, there he is, he's in a car. And there's Joe Biden. And you can see them thinking, sorry, when's the joke? When do I get to the bit that's the joke? And they go, oh, no, oh, I have to actually think of the joke as I go along. So they do the rhythms of it going to be
like
funny.
Like a cargo cult. And eventually a joke will just come into my head and I'll say it.
And it doesn't. And I feel, I always feel awful. But I did it with Jess Phillips, who can absolutely handle herself. And Ruth Davidson also can completely handle herself. And for people like that, it's a great show to do because
neither of them have a fraud conviction. I think it helps.
Yeah. But, you know, in that world, you know, it does, it opens up doors for you and people can see who you are as a real human being. And, you know, Jess Phillips will have a go at the Labour Party and Ruth Davidson will have a go at the Tory Party. So they're sort of, you know, fairly Teflon in that regard. So I think it can be useful if you are a good, funny, strong personality. I think if I'm the producer of Have I Got News For You and Ruth Davidson wants to come on, great, I get two things. I get a politician who can talk in a certain way and also I get someone who's going to be entertaining.
An entertainment booking.
Yeah. And if there is someone like a Louise Hague, well, I can't lose because either she's great, you think, oh, brilliant, that's someone I can now book for the next five series and she'll have an insight into the Labour Party and that's very, very useful. And if she's bad, that's good as well because people like seeing a politician do badly. If I book a comic and they don't do well, that's hard. There's no one gains from that. If I book a politician and they don't do well, then this
it all feeds into the show and it becomes quite viral.
Obviously, they would rather people do well because that makes bookings easier for the future. But there is nothing to lose if you're the producers by booking a politician. There always is something to lose if you are a politician. But
I think she also had something tactical to prove. I think she knew that it would be in the week of lots of people talking about Rachel Reeves's failure to declare the thing on the rental agreement. And she wanted to say, well, I was treated up because I was, when my fraud conviction came to light, I keep saying the word fraud conviction, you see, this is the problem with it.
Yeah.
But when it came to light, I was got rid of as transport minister and she hasn't been got rid of as chancellor. And I think she kind of wanted to say, this has been unfair.
Yeah.
This is not the forum to do this.
Yeah, it's like Zach Polanski has made your fraud conviction bigger with the use of hypnosis. But I get it. It is a siren call, and if you're asked to do it, there is something about Have I Got News For You? It's one of those shows that does have a cachet, and is that sort of thing. Like you think, oh, maybe I could. Maybe I've watched that show for many, many years, and my friends say I'm funny. So you do see them get halfway through a bit. You have to know where this bit is finishing when you start it. There's every comic who's on this show. They've thought of the joke first, and the setup is them going, how do I set up that joke? I'll say this. That's worth looking out for. But Polanski, listen, who knows? I'm fascinated to see it tomorrow or today if you're listening to this on Friday, or yesterday if you're listening to this on Saturday. It's available on iPlayer.
Okay, a question from Derek Lord. He says, how much rehearsal is there between TV interviewers and their guests? How much is spontaneous and how much is pre-planned?
I mean, it depends on the show, really. Most things, it's spontaneous. On pretty much any show you go on, you will have a briefing call the day before. If you're on Lorraine or if you're on Graham Norton or if you're on BBC Breakfast or any of these things, you'll have a briefing call and they'll say, because usually you're on something because you're promoting. And so it's those briefing calls are a bit for them and a bit for you. So, you know, if you're promoting a book, you know, they'll say, oh, so tell us about the book, tell us this, that, or the other. I read an interview, you said this. They're essentially, they know they have to set up, you know, write a list of notes for their presenter to, you know, when you come on, if you're on Beauty Breakfast, you're there for 7 minutes or whatever, and they just need to know. They said, oh, we'll talk about the book, then maybe we'll talk about, if it's me, maybe we'll talk a bit about House of Games and what's happening with that, and maybe, oh, you, I know that you're a big fan of Celebrity Traitors, maybe we'll talk about that. So you'll have an idea of what might be asked of you. Certainly they won't tell you what the questions are, and the first question will be, yeah, will usually be the thing you know it's going to be. But good interviewers, like, you go on Beauty Breakfast and someone like Charlie State, he never sticks to what the questions are, and he knows that, you know, if depending on who his guest is, that they're able to kind of go off script. So there'll always be a briefing, so the presenters will know roughly what the guest thinks is going to happen. The guests will roughly know what the interviewer is going to ask, but most good interviews sort of come off the back of that. That's just to keep everyone safe. If you've got something like Graham Norton, that's slightly different, because it's an entertainment show, and the real skill of Graham Norton is he has those four guests there all the time, and it's about knitting them together, is they will always do a thing where they'll try and find some connection between the guests. So your briefing interview on that will not be, because they know who you are and what it is that you do, you know, and so they'll say, oh, and, you know, Mariah Carey is on, have you ever, you know, what's your thoughts on Mariah Carey, or Tom Hanks is on, and this, that, or the other. So that's more them as producers just thinking, I wonder if there's a bit of fun for Graham after he's done the main bit of the interview, when he, you know, those fun bits of Graham Norton, which is always, I was on with Chris and Rosie Ramsey doing the Hamilton rap to Lin-Manuel Miranda, because, and, you know, things like that. So the skill to those things is to make it as light a touch as possible, to make people feel comfortable, because lots of people going on those shows have not done those things before. So just to make them feel like, look, don't worry, there's not gonna be anything too terrifying. That if you have a presenter like Charlie and Nagar on the BBC who are interviewing 15 different people across a show, that every time a new thing starts, they can just look down at a bit of paper and go, okay, I know where my starting point is. Yeah. So it's that. Occasionally you'll do shows. I did Jack Whitehall, and Michael Whitehall had a show once, and I was on that with McFly, which is, for me, was a thrill. And I started saying something or other, and I became aware that that was very, very scripted. And sometimes shows are just comedy shows, you know, so it's you can't really do anything at all. So some shows aren't really interview shows. They're really comedy shows. But for the good interview shows, you'll always have a briefing. So you'll always, you know, they'll say, oh, we talk about this, we talk about that. But you'll come off afterwards and go, oh, we didn't talk about any of those things.
No.
In the end.
But in the US, on those late night shows, God, that is a totally different ballgame. The publicist has spent a long time getting, you know, whoever it is, whichever star's promoting this, whether it's Glenn Powell, whether it's whoever, some, when they know they're doing a press tour, their best anecdotes, funny things that people may not, or things that may not have been surfaced. And they will parcel those out, and they will tell the people, and then, you know, whether this person is going on Stephen Colbert or, you know, Seth Meyers or wherever, will tee them up to tell this anecdote. And so much of that, as you say, they might completely deviate, but they've got three absolute banker anecdotes that you can get out of Kate Hudson or whoever it is.
Yeah, I was
that
watching
week.
A Jason Isaacs one where they were getting to do British accents, and all of that is pre-planned and pre-prepared. But always the stuff that is best, and every producer will tell you this, and every chat show host will tell you this, and every great chat show guest will tell you this, the best stuff is always the stuff that isn't planned. But to get to that stuff, you do need to plan stuff.
It's I agree. And it's like in anything, it's like in theatre or whatever, or in comedy, when people have that sense that they're seeing something that is just a response to something that's gone wrong in the show that night, and just a bit of covering, those get the hugest laughs, because it there's something in the ether that, you know, it's spontaneous and it just happened, and it's an ad lib and it's brilliant. And those are always the things that just catch light. And especially with those kind of US shows where I think that it can feel increasing, you know, and that's the whole point of things like Hot Ones, which is that it just disrupts everything because you're having very hot chicken wings. Those are disruptions to that kind of format, where it was a really quite carefully mapped out dance. But I agree with you, yes, anything that happens spontaneously, you can always tell.
Shall we go to a break? And after the break, we have a question from, I think what the greatest answer we were ever given was about sounds in nature documentaries, which Steve Backshall very, very kindly, and if you've not listened to that episode, he gives us such a brilliant answer. But Backshall is back because he has a question this time, which we'll ask straight after these. Welcome back, everybody. I promised Steve Backshall, and I'm delivering. Backshall says, hi, Richard and Marina. Who do you think are the top 10 Wow. Who do you think are the top 10 fictional animals in TV and film?
Well,
that's up your street, isn't
Steve,
it?
As you know, I love you. I love this question. You're going to go nuts, Richard, because I haven't actually put them in a top 10 order. But
what
I have
mean?
Got.
What have you done?
I've got 10 amazing animal, and I've done performances. This is like animals that can actually act.
Yeah, I'm but not gonna... which is best, though? Which of them is best?
Okay.
Oh, no, because presumably...
All right, I'll do it.
Presumably... No, this is... Sorry, I just... For logic. Presumably, there was an 11th best.
Well, there are some that, yeah, have not made the cut, it's quite sad. Sorry, Lassie.
Oh, no, but so there was...
You're not in there.
So we're saying there was an 11th.
And I'll tell you why, because there were a lot of Lassie, actually. There were a lot of Lassie.
A lot of... Sorry, I'm just... I'm going to... Minister, I apologize, I'm going to have to keep asking this question. You accept that there was an 11th placed animal... But you're not accepting there's a 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th, 6th.
I'm not doing them in an order. I'm going to give you 10 amazing animal performances where the animals are unbelievably good at acting.
Are you going to at least end on the one that you think is the best?
I'll have to decide while I'm doing it. Yeah, okay.
Otherwise, well, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll end on the 7th best. Why don't we do that? That's a really great, that'd be a great way to end this
I'm
section.
I'm starting now. The item is now
Why
starting.
Why don't we disappoint Steve Backshall? That'd be a lovely way to start
Don't do that.
Day.
Don't come at me with that. That's unbelievable.
No, I want you to be the best you can be. You know that. I don't want you to disappoint yourself in front of Backshall. You know I don't.
Right. I'm going to start with a really vicious one. I don't know why I'm in a really vicious mood now. But the dog in John Carpenter's movie, The Thing, is unbelievable. Okay, there's some scenes in that, and I just was thinking about this, and I thought I'm going to have to actually go and rewatch those. That it's like a wolf dog. The actual dog itself is called Jed. There's a moment where it's running from
it. It seems much less scary
at
when
the start.
Jed.
Yeah, right. I know, but it's really not less scary. There's a scene in the kennels which is quite traumatizing, presumably also for the other dogs who are playing in that scene. But this dog can seriously act. We'll try and get some of these dogs out of the way altogether. That dog in Anatomy of a Fall is brilliant. Yeah. Messy is absolutely brilliant. The dog in The Artist, Uggy. Do you remember there's a whole like campaign like why is this dog not getting a nomination? This is so good.
Yeah. Let me give you some reasons why the dog is not getting a nomination.
Exactly. It's not how this business works. Terry, who's the dog that plays Toto in The Wizard of Oz, an iconic performance, probably treated far better by MGM than Judy Garland was, very depressingly, but there we go, that's a period piece. I respect Lassie, but there were a lot of Lassies.
There were so many Lassies. That's like the MGM lion. There were a lot of MGM lions.
We've talked about this before on a previous episode, so I won't go in too much into Rin Tin Tin, but Rin Tin Tin literally saved a studio, literally pretty much saves Warner's, was an incredible performer, was rescued from World War II. I mean, it's an amazing story. So, okay, that's dealt with the dogs. The cat in Alien, Jonesy, because that's like a cult move. Well, it's a relationship.
I think a cat actor, because it's harder to act if you're a cat, I think. Because it's not in your nature. Dogs are very eager to please. Dogs are very directable.
Yeah.
Cats are very undirectable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, famously, it's directing cats in this one. And so I would say the bitch...
It's like herding actors.
Herding actors. The donkey in The Banshees of Inisherin. Oh, my God. She's amazing. Jenny.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, she is absolutely incredible in that film. There's two extremely good actors, Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell. Jenny, I mean, more than holding her own with those two. She's brilliant in that. I heard that Martin McDonagh, who wrote it, he didn't really want her to have to work again after this because she'd done so well. And as far as I know, she lives on a sort of lovely lovely sanctuary in County Carlow.
She's probably literally going, why is my phone not ringing?
Why is my career stalled? Yeah.
She's like waiting for her agent the whole time, just going, no, but I think it did well because I think Colin has done stuff, hasn't he? Since then, and Brendan has done bits and bobs. I just don't feel... And Kerry's done quite a lot, hasn't she? So she'd...
Kerry's
no, it's fine.
I
saw Kerry in the F1 movie. I just went to see it in Waterford, and I was just thinking, oh, because we were, I just. So anyway, I'm available, and Martin McDonagh's going
Just change your agent, Jenny. But she's amazing. Speaking of people who never saw Crystal the Monkey, like that is a far better CV than almost all actors of her
journey.
Crystal the Monkey, which is everything. She's in George of the Jungle, Night at the Museum, all the Nights at the Museum, in the Spielberg's The Fablemans, Hangover 2. She's a drug dealing monkey in Hangover 2. She's in Community. Okay, that is a better CV than most human actors of her generation.
Okay, I mean, I don't think there is the rest is philosophy, but I'm very much against dogs getting Oscars. But Monkey's getting Oscars?
Yeah. Oh, Monkey should have Oscars, for definite. There should, yeah.
But you know what I mean? Is that, that feels like maybe it's a thing.
Yeah. I mean, she was amazing. Crystal is amazing. I think she's, Crystal's still with us, actually, but she's very, very good. This is a bit of a weird one. I'm going to put Cheetah in from the Tarzan movies because that I loved that book so much. I don't know if anyone ever read that book. It's brilliant. It's called Me Cheetah, and it's a sort of fake showbiz memoir, but it's a really great way of exploring that time.
By James Lever.
Yeah, by James Lever. And I really, that's a wonderful one. And I, what have I got to end with? I've got,
oh my God, have you not, I assumed at the bottom of the page you had this. Yeah. Is, yeah.
I think the horse.
Rachel's listening.
It's horses, and it's very difficult for me to get the best. I was good.
Wow.
The one who plays Joey in Warhorse.
Yeah.
Is very good. Black Beauty, again, that, I mean, Black Beauty, that's amazing because that's an incredible performance. But actually, there's a Viggo Mortensen movie called Hidalgo, and there's a horse in that that is absolutely, that's extraordinary. I don't know, Steve, those are my top 10. I've got to choose one for the top one. Maybe it
no,
is.
No, I'll choose one for the top one because I know
okay,
the top
on.
One. The Littlest Hobo. Easy. Done. Job done.
How many hobos were there, really?
There were four.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but because they had a gap, they had a but late hobo.
It's inexcusable. No, what late hobo?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, that's the 11th animal then, isn't
yeah,
it?
The latest hobo
rocketed to number one. Okay, thank you for that question, Steve. I always like to work with animals. A question for you, Richard, from John Hopkins, who says that Phineas, the brother and songwriting partner of Billie Eilish, was recently commissioned by Apple to write the new mnemonic. The few seconds of music that plays with the logo for Apple TV. How will he get paid for this? Why would Apple bother paying an A-lister who's presumably going to cost a fortune? Is he really going to be that much better than anyone else?
Huh. I wonder if that's John Hopkins, the musician.
I don't know.
I mean, it's very in his fit. He's an amazing electronic musician.
He would have
John
quite
Hopkins
liked
would
to have
know
done it.
Yeah, exactly. He's thinking, oh, why can I not do that?
Yeah.
First, Phineas, A-list or not, Marina?
No. Phineas? Yeah. Oh my God, don't be ridiculous. Not even close.
So with this one, I think it's good publicity for Apple to have Phineas doing that. This would be a buyout because these things can end up being incredibly expensive when they're not buyouts. There's been a whole history of this. Brian Eno did the music for Windows 95, that startup chime. Mm-hmm. That was Brian Eno, and it was 3.25 seconds long and said it took him literally forever, and he became incredibly sensitized to microseconds of music and knew exactly when, you know, when it was 3:24 he knew it, when it was 3:26.
It is a recipe to send a musician mad, isn't it, this sort of thing?
Yeah, I think exactly that. And, you know, things like the I'm Loving It jingle, you know, the kind of hip-hop version, the I'm Loving It, that went out to a million...
For McDonald's.
For McDonald's, that went out to a million ad agencies around the world. A German firm won it in the end, and Justin Timberlake got paid $6 million for singing it, so he got over $1 million a second. But my favourite one, and again, this is why Phineas will be on a buyout rather than anything else. There's a guy called David Dundas who was the son of the Marquess of Zetland, and was a sort of jingle composer. Had a big hit with Jeans On. People were known from the 70s. But he did. Do you remember the four note Channel 4 music?
Yes.
That was obvious. He wrote that. And he would get paid quite a nice amount of money every single time it was used. And that was used before every single Channel 4 show, after every Channel 4 show, for around about 15 years. He made a seven-figure sum from doing...
That's great for the great Aristo permanent poverty crisis that there was pleading. Why don't you all just write a little jingle and then we don't have to hear about your houses?
Yeah. Exactly.
And how expensive the roofs are.
Do your little jingle. So Phineas, I imagine, will be... I mean, he'll be paid a lot for it because, again, it's a publicity
It's the computer company, Richard.
Thing. Yeah.
There's funny money for these companies.
Yeah,
they'll have this one sewn up, believe me.
But John Hopkins, if you are the John Hopkins, then, it feels like let's get John Hopkins to do the next one.
Yeah.
Don't you think? You can send, if it is the John Hopkins, send us a little four-note mnemonic that we can play on The Rest Is Entertainment.
You've tried to send a musician mad, is what you've done.
How will we pay you? Free membership. How about that? Which is, I mean, that's worth
how
more
about
than,
that?
That's worth more than the Marquess of Zetland got. Marina, a question for you from Ellie. Thank you, Ellie. Ellie asks, could paid product placements in novels become a thing? And why are Instagram influencers required to use a sponsored hashtag, but other mediums, like TV and film, don't have to?
Very good question. It has I think it's almost like a historic thing because it has become a thing in the past and it never worked. And there are just a few examples which I'll give you and then I'll tell you where I think this kind of sponsorship is going. The first one that I think people knew about was Faye Weldon wrote a book called The Bulgari Connection, which was Bulgari, the jewellery brand, said, you've got to, if you do this, they obviously, this was in the year 2000.
She was like a writer in residence for Bulgari, wasn't she?
Yeah. I mean, this is like one of those weird jobs. And actually, William Boyd did a Land Rover thing a bit like this, but, and they said, you've got to mention it 12 times. And I think she did it 34 times. I mean, if it's a novel called The Bulgari Collection, Connection, rather, I think there's quite a few times.
I would just make my killer Dave Bulgari.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Much easier. Then there was a couple of sort of chick lit ones where cars were in it. I think Ford Fiesta got a novelist to change the VW Beetle to a Ford Fiesta. YA novels did a few sort of skincare things and makeup brands. As I said, William Boyd, I think, did one, but William Boyd did a sort of Land Rover, kind of like a short story. And they said to him, you can sort of do anything you like, but could it possibly have a Land Rover in it? And he did something called The Vanishing Game, and it was really like doing a very fancy ad, and you could click on it and little films came up.
To
it was
my
kind
mind,
of an adventure
William
story.
William Boyd can do whatever he wants.
But I think it wasn't like he was publishing I agree, and it wasn't like he was publishing a novel. It was sort of like a
Knew what it was.
Like a movie director doing an ad, you know, something a bit like that. There was one book called Waiting at Hayden's, which was weird. It's like a digital book and you could shop the clothes that the characters were wearing. Or you'll probably know by the time I've got to that point, you'll think, actually, all that feels really old fashioned and it's not really how we consume things anymore. In Richard's book, for example, Richard's books have lots and lots of brand names in, but none of them are sponsored because it's a form of realism. We've talked about this before. Yeah. It's a brilliant form of shorthand. It's sometimes just mentioning them is a joke.
I must have more brands than...
No sponsorship.
No sponsorship. But you know what? As soon as I read this question, I'm like, hold on a minute.
I'm
missing a trick here.
But I think that the trick has moved on, really, because people are so... Something else that we talked about when we talked about product placement is that people are so used to forms of, I mean, influencing is a form of story, isn't it? If you're a lifestyle influencer, if you're one of these people, even like if you're like Molly May or if you're Millie McIntosh, you know, your story is a sort of, in some ways, perhaps a lightly fictionalized account of your own life, and you're constantly selling via it. People see selling as in a totally different way now. I would say that the next frontier in product placement is already happening. It's personalized and dynamic. When I was doing research about Marvel films, it was very interesting. They would say, oh, yeah, you know, in all the different territories, whatever's in that cooler that they're going to walk past, it will be different drinks in every different territory. So they're digitally inserting all these different things. That's according to territories and where you are. What they are now starting to do, and particularly in Asia, this is really taking off, is that it's according to your preferences, your purchase history. And I think you'll see on streaming in the future things that will be tailored to you in the background of scenes that are literally based on your search history and the way you've interacted with the algorithm.
So if you just looked up a chair and you know that currently on Facebook every single advert is now for a chair, suddenly, you'll be watching The Diplomat and in the background there'll be like a chair that you just looked at.
Hang on a minute. Already now, in some places in Asia, you can click on what a character's wearing, and I suppose you could click on their chair as well. But I think
sorry to be chair obsessed.
And obviously, the in gaming, it's already part of that ecosystem, and that there are virtual stores, there are wearables, the skins, vehicles. You don't mind it there. I think the big and the most interesting one is, which is obviously coming up at a kind of rate of knots, is when it becomes conversational in AI. And whether you, I mean, that is, I want to say it's a minefield, but it's kind of like all mine. There's no bits of field. That feels to me very, very dangerous. But I think that's already where it's going. And there are already big sort of ethics conversations about that.
Yeah, I think anything non-editorial is absolutely fine because, you know, people have got to wear clothes and drive cars and what have you. Yeah, the second it's plot driven or, you know, conversation driven, then that's an issue because then what are you watching?
But there is the idea of the dissolution of a kind of shared fictional creative reality. And in fact, because it's so personalised to you and you're seeing a different version of The Diplomat,
you're getting a different
chair to me. I think there's lots of ethical and creative problems with that. But within AI, I think in terms of people's conversations with AI chatbots and so on, that is a real frontier that we don't really know. And as always with these things, we have no idea what they're doing and whether what's already happening. But I think we can assume that, as I say, like a minefield where it's kind of all mine.
Oh, my God.
Well, one for you, Richard, from Ben, who says, celebrities often appear on TV shows with captions with their name and profession. Do the celebrities get a say in what is displayed? Richard, as someone with lots of strings to your bow, what is your preferred job title?
I always find it fascinating when people are, you know, like on Celebritators, when I think Tom Daly was Olympian and entrepreneur. So, yeah, you definitely do get a choice in how. I mean, listen, if he'd said, you know, Olympian and rocket scientist, they wouldn't have allowed it. But yes, you do have a choice. If ever I'm introduced, I'll always try and have author first, because it takes a very long time to, you know, it's if you do different things, it's like a super tanker changing, you know, how people think about you. But my favorite version of this is always on celebrity game shows, where people introduce themselves. It's always my least favorite thing in the whole world. And they'd always say, I'm so and so and so, and you will know me from. And you're like, ah, oh, because that is a conversation that's had to be had. And you get people, you know, people who maybe whose main fame was in the 80s, for example, but feel like they've done a lot of work since then, and they are, you know, are less comfortable saying, you'll know me from the 1985 Eurovision Song Contest. You know, yeah. They want to say, you'll know me from my new podcast that I'm doing about parenting. And so, yeah, there's negotiations as to how somebody is billed, both in those what you call Astons, those little you know, written things on screen, but mainly in the introduction to things. I was watching I'm a Celebrity, and that's, it's all you will know me from,
yeah,
you know, and people sort of telling you who they are, but you will know me from sends such a shiver down my spine. It would always, when we did Point to Celebrities, I would, you know, they'd almost be kind of written out, and I was I just sort of think this doesn't feel right.
Well, no, there are times when it is just too glaring, and you've just got to be realistic about where you will be known from. Yeah. And definitely Tom Daly's agent, or whoever his management is, who said he's got to be Olympian and entrepreneur,
yeah,
and he's got to have a shower scene. I don't care when he's leaving. Unless, you know, the shower scene just happened accidentally.
But a lot of people now have, you know, presenter and podcaster, because, you know, it's not, you know, anyone.
Just say presenter and human. Like I've said to you, all humans in the year 2025 have a podcast. Yeah. So you just, there's no need.
But yeah, it's you know, everything is personal branding. We know that. And, you know, for most people, it's easy if you're an actor or if you're a musician or whatever it is. But if you are multi-hyphenate in any way, or if you've found your way to fame via a reality TV show, for example, then, you know, that will often be someone is, you know, business person and podcaster. And you think, huh, I thought you were from Made in Chelsea.
Yeah.
I thought we knew from, I don't think people know you as a business person and podcast. I think people know you as that person from Made in Chelsea. But listen, everyone's on the grift.
You can only describe yourself as a businessman in this country. As like, we've got like three famous businessmen. There are people like Richard, yeah, Branson. I mean, no, you can't. Like, maybe James Dyson.
James Dyson, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Jamie Lang.
you can't call yourself, yeah, a businessman until you're that famous for business.
Yeah, actually, Jamie Lang, he is actually one of the only people in the world. He's quite a successful podcaster and quite a successful businessman. So I'll let him off. But everyone else, it's like when rich people call themselves film producer.
Oh, my God, that's unacceptable.
You mean someone asked you for money and you said yes? Come on. So, yeah, those job titles, yeah, I've always, because author is the thing I spend most of my time doing, so I'll always call myself that. But if people call me TV presenter or whatever, or producer, people have started calling me, especially in foreign countries, comedian. That I try and really stamp down on that. Because if people think you're a comedian, then you have, yeah, to be funny. Whereas I've always got away with, you know, anything funny I say, people go, oh my God, he's not even a comedian. Whereas if you're a comedian, you have to be funny. So I'm not a comedian. I am an author, businessman, and philanthropist.
Yeah, philanthropist is another one. Yeah, that, yeah, is.
That's me.
And entirely unacceptable.
And podcaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That about wraps us up. But tomorrow we have got, for our members, we've got a very special behind-the-scenes episode from The Lion King, and like the absolute blockbuster, yeah, musical that's been setting London on fire.
Lovely sort of behind, you know, like talking to everyone who's involved, yeah, how it's put together, all just behind-the-scenes stories and what a day in the life of The Lion King looks like.
So if you want to join for ad-free listening and all the rest of it, it's therestasentertainment.com and the bonus episodes. Otherwise, we will see you next Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday.